Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the value of literature to America's armed forces? In addition to their training in military tactics, technology, and physical strength and endurance, cadets at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point are required to complete coursework equivalent to that of any other elite university. Elizabeth D. Samet has been teaching literature at West Point since 1997, and especially since 9/11, has been keenly aware of the ways her students can use the prose and poetry they study together to gain perspective on the complex meanings of courage, leadership, obedience, and honor in their personal and professional lives. She wrote about her experiences as a professor in her 2007 book, Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature through Peace and War at West Point. And she's in town this week to receive the 2012 Hyatt Prize in Humanities from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Before we get started, I want to read this disclaimer. The opinions expressed here by Elizabeth Samet are her own and do not necessarily reflect those of the Military Academy, the Department of the Army, or the Department of Defense. That's a first for us, but I guess now you can say whatever the heck comes to mind. talk about this, Elizabeth. What do cadets learn in your class in literature that maybe is different or has a different significance than they would if they were at Yale?
Well, I think the biggest difference, of course, is the context, that they all know at the end of their 4 years they'll be commissioned as second lieutenants in the Army. Now, what they think that means can be radically different from cadet to cadet, but it all has that context. So everything we do in the classroom has it. That doesn't mean that we talk about it all the time. I had a friend who teaches at another university who came to my poetry class one day, and he said, that was like a poetry class anywhere. And I said, well, I hope so.
Yeah.
That's my goal. But there are moments when the conversation will take a very different turn because the cadets connect whatever it is we're reading. And it need not be war literature when that happens, but it can be. Or they're reading about an issue of loyalty or an issue of responsibility in a text, and they draw a particular professional connection. And I always find it works best when they do it. When I draw a connection, it kind of falls flat and it feels heavy-handed. But when they see themselves, it's quite wonderful. And they also find things in the texts, even texts I'm very familiar with that I've never seen before. And that's always a wonderful moment.
Have any of your students had active duty experience before maybe they decided to get into West Point?
Yes, some have. We have a group of cadets called prior service cadets. And those are students who have served enlisted time before coming to West Point. Mm-hmm. And over the last several years, many of those have combat experience. So I had one several years ago now. He actually just graduated, but he was a freshman, a plebe, as we call them, in the introductory literature course. And he gave a kind of gravity and grounding to our conversation that was really quite remarkable, particularly the text that I'm thinking of that he had a connection with was Macbeth. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about several of the students were talking about the ease with which Macbeth becomes a murderer. And this student had very different understandings of death and also of responsibility and Macbeth's role as a soldier and then his departure from his sort of sense of duty and his sense of military life and embarking, of course, on a very different criminal path. And mm-hmm. So this student brought completely different contexts to it and really enriched the conversation.
Do you have to sort of balance the deference that the students who don't have prior service might show to a student who does?
There is sometimes, I think, they feel a kind of chasm. Mm-hmm. But I also think they look to those students for leadership. And I think also the students who have had prior service respond to some of the pressures of the academy in very interesting ways, in that it's just they just sort of take each day and they don't really let things bother them too much. They have a great sense of equanimity, and that's wonderful to see in the classroom. And sometimes it makes them more comfortable with texts they're unfamiliar with or literature they're unfamiliar with. Because they're willing to take a risk and take a chance. But I generally find that all of the cadets are, if you set up the the conditions in the classroom where they know that that's a safe place to do that.
You write about the fact that these cadets are simultaneously being educated and indoctrinated, which is what you need at a military academy. At the same time, I'm curious about how you give them a sense that they ought to be skeptical but not cynical, and where the line falls, and how much you have to do with the decision they make about that line.
It is a very interesting line, and one that I do, as you've suggested, navigate all the time and have been trying to figure out for as long as I've been there. It's a sort of fault line that has been inherent in the institution since it began. But I think by and large it manages it quite well. I think part of any freshman coming to college has to learn a new culture. And I think part of the most difficult challenge perhaps for the freshman is figuring out when to turn that on and off, and when someone wants to hear their opinion about something and when they just need to go do whatever they're told to do. So it can create, in the beginning of a semester, it can create some really long, painful silences until you make it clear that you really want to hear what they have to say. And so you then see that they learn how to turn that on and off. But I hope that they never lose the thoughtfulness that we encourage and the questioning that we encourage in class. And I find that they really do figure out, for the most part, fairly quickly how to make those two things work. That isn't to say there aren't challenges, but I do think we make that work well.
First week of class for the freshmen, the plebes, are they looking at your class as a respite from everything else? Are they looking at it as a distraction? And do you see that sort of idea morph over the course of a semester?
It's very interesting. They come in with very different perspective. So some will imagine English class as something completely different, radically different from their military training or anything. So when we do talk about war in literature, because sometimes that's a hard subject actually to avoid in literature, they're sometimes disappointed. I don't want to do that here. I want to do something else here. Mm-hmm. And then others, I think, have a very strict sense of responsibility, that every moment should be spent helping them to prepare for being an officer. And I think that's true too, but I have a slightly different philosophy of preparation. And so there are some who will say, you know, how does this relate to my being a lieutenant? Mm-hmm. And I would rather have them ask the question, how does this relate to me being, to my being a human being who is also a lieutenant, who leads a rich and full life, who knows how to go to war, but also who knows how to come home, which is arguably more difficult.
To what extent do you want to just leave them with a sense that things are complicated, that right and wrong are very nuanced depending on the situation?
That's certainly, I think, one of the great values of literature, especially the literature we read, you know, that it isn't giving – it's not a fable with a moral at the end, but that the jury is often out, and that part of what they have to learn is that they will confront many situations in which no one will declare – this is right or this is wrong, and they have to figure it out themselves. And often they will have to choose the best of some very bad choices, and that's not an easy thing to learn as well.
So you're a civilian, along with about 20% of the faculty at
Correct.
West Point?
Yes.
I'm curious about I would imagine that you want your students to challenge you in class and to bring up ideas that they don't understand or they disagree with. How does the overall military culture of the place affect the willingness of students to sort of stand up and stick their neck out and say, I don't think so?
Well, it's interesting. Certainly with the freshmen, there's a kind of waiting period in class, and they aren't exactly sure. Even though I'm a civilian, all of the classes are technically military formations. Mm-hmm. So there is someone in each class, a cadet who's called the section marcher, who actually calls everyone to attention at the beginning of class. It's a very formal ritual.
That must be nice. I'm sure lots of professors would love to have that.
It is great. It does enable you to get their attention and then to get started. But when I first arrived there, I thought, how am I ever going to – you want to set up the beginning of class and you think, how am I ever going to recover after this? But then it becomes exactly, as you suggest, something you value. So there is a kind of military formality to the beginning of class. And there is an etiquette, I think, a military etiquette that makes it seem more formal than another institution. But once you get into the discussion and into the class, that sort of recedes. And it isn't that the respect recedes or that it's somehow they forget who they are or where they are, but they realize that it is a conversation in which they have a role and a responsibility. And so there's always a moment in class when some some cadet will, not the upperclassmen who know me, but already, but the freshmen will venture to argue and disagree. Mm-hmm. And then there's a little moment where the others will look around and say, oh what's going to happen?
Right.
And when I say, bring it on, that's mm-hmm. great, then there's suddenly this realization that, yeah, I really do want to hear what they have to say. I want them to back it up with evidence, and I'll challenge them, but they can do the same to me. And there's really kind of a, I think, a nice relationship that evolves as a result of that.
Even the most committed students in any field occasionally have misgivings about, you know, whether they've chosen the right path, whether they're in the right place. I wonder how candid students feel about revealing their fears, not only for their physical safety in the years to come, but about the correctness of their choices.
I think I've had a lot of conversations about precisely those issues. And it's always a very difficult moment when a student comes in and tells you, I'm not sure whether this is right for me. And so in those moments, I always try to think of something that a mentor of mine who was a colonel there when I first arrived, he had this wonderful capacity of laying out all the facets of a given issue but never telling you what to do mm-hmm. and leaving it to you. And so I try to use that as a model. You know, you can't really tell anyone how to live his or her life. And so I just try to give them the richest understanding of the choices and of all the different aspects and just serve as a sounding board there. And I've seen students I greatly admire, students I think would be wonderful officers who leave, and then others who go through a really difficult time and they think they want to leave and they're not sure, but they stick it out and they're ultimately happy with their choice. And I think the Army is better for having them. And also better for having people who do question, is this the right choice? Mm-hmm. And question that early on rather than waking up one day, 5, 10 years, 15 years in and saying, was this the right choice?
You know, of course, we need young, strong, capable people in the military, leaders in the military. But it does seem we're asking a lot of young people who are at West Point and other military academies in a society where adolescence keeps getting extended and people are quite often sort of not fully launched until they're in their mid-20s in this country.
And it is that sometimes they do seem to me very young mm-hmm. in the classroom, and I realize how young they are and then how much responsibility they will have when they are only 21, 22 years old. And so in some ways they have to be wise beyond their years. They have to be mature beyond their years. But you're also dealing with 19 and 20-year-olds. And so there's this wonderful combination of sometimes they just want to be 19.
Yeah.
And yet they know deep down that they're going to have to take responsibility for other people. And that's, you know, that's the hard thing. That's what makes you grow up really fast. And I've seen a lot of them grow up really fast.
I wonder about the specter of graduation because, you know, at other universities, you're going on to your first job or you're thinking about grad school. It's a different situation for your students.
It is an unbelievable day. You graduate in the morning and then get commissioned as a second lieutenant a few hours later. One year I went to a graduation and commissioning, and then the cadet got married the same day, so a wedding as well. And I was exhausted. I don't know how he managed it. But cadets can't be married while they're at the academy, so getting married that first day or immediately afterwards is not an unpopular choice. So I think it's really a complicated day, much more complicated than my own college graduation. Yes, they know what they're going to be doing, but how do you process all of that at once?
Elizabeth D. Samet is my guest. She's professor of literature at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and author of Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature Through Peace and War at West Point. She's in town to receive the 2012 Hyatt Prize in Humanities from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture tomorrow night. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Elizabeth D. Samet. She's professor of literature at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and winner of the 2012 Hyatt Prize in Humanities from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. Her book is called Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature Through Peace and War at West Point. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about your title, Soldier's Heart, because I had not heard before reading the book that this was sort of an antiquated term for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right. When it first was diagnosed around the Civil War and after, soldiers evidently presented with symptoms that seemed to be related to heart trouble. But it wasn't. And so it acquired this name, Soldier's Heart, which actually continued, I think, through World War I. But then shell shock eclipsed it, and post-traumatic stress disorder. But it struck me as apt for some of the challenges and the particular kinds of suffering and the sort of invisible suffering that soldiers often undergo.
Do you have a sense that your students feel that they will be spared this, or is it something they fear as much as being physically injured?
I don't think they fear it. When they go off to war, I think they're too preoccupied with the many things they have to know mm-hmm. and do at the time. But I do know that coming home is a difficult thing. And I think we have a tendency culturally, on the one hand, to celebrate soldiers in a kind of anonymous way and just sort of a group. And on the other hand, to pathologize them as we did sort of. That's a hangover from Vietnam, I mm-hmm. think, the Vietnam vet who can never get readjusted. And they're... There are examples of that. There are examples of plenty of Vietnam veterans who adjusted quite well. And
right.
So there's this sense that we like it in the extreme version, and that sort of sells movies and things. but I think there are lots of challenges that soldiers face and that they can reacclimate and that they can come home, but that there's always a recognition that things are never quite the same and that they can put their experiences behind them, but that those experiences have changed them and changed people they know. And I think that's something they have to come to terms with.
Do a lot of your students keep writing after they leave your class?
They do. They keep writing to me and as a correspondent, which mm-hmm. is great. And it's something I never expected. And they also, in some of those letters and emails, send me the poems and short stories they're working on. And some of them have ambitions to write in the future. And so I think it helps them. I think they find it therapeutic to be able to write about these things, both in correspondence and then also in fiction and poetry and things like that. And some of them are quite accomplished. And I think it's lovely that they're able to find the time to do that.
How often when you assign a text, do you do so with the awareness that it may not resonate right now, but 5 years from now, it's going to take on an entirely different meaning?
I think sometimes I do imagine that for certain texts. Sometimes because you can't predict the news cycle and you can't predict what will happen when you choose your course text, let's say 6 months out or something mm-hmm. like that, how world events will change the significance of a given text. But I do try to choose a lot of texts that will maybe seem strange to them, maybe seem as if, what does this have to do with me or my time of life? And then they will circle back to it. They'll come back to it. And they'll see that it has an application they never imagined it to have.
Okay, so West Point is now co-educational. We know that women are making huge contributions in the U.S. military in all four branches. But the vast majority of war literature is very focused on men's experience. What do you do with that? And how do you incorporate the experiences of your female students into the class?
It is difficult to find models in literature for women at war, even though women have been at war, and there are several exceptions. Mostly women are portrayed on the home front, mm-hmm. watching soldiers go to war. And so that is something we have to navigate. We often think about those texts and the maleness of those texts, but then think about some of the attributes of soldiers admirable soldiers in literature, or not so admirable soldiers, and think about the attributes they have. Are they gender specific? Do they transcend gender? And of course, you know, the vast majority of them do. Women can be loyal, men can be loyal, men and women can be disloyal. And so there are all sorts of ways in which I try to abstract some of those qualities and to suggest that, you know, this isn't exclusively about male soldiers, although it is, and all much of literature is, and we have to talk about that too, and about the notion that that war is still by many perceived to be a masculine endeavor. And so what does that mean for them as women in the military?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Has West Point ever tried to limit the texts from which you teach?
West Point is a strong proponent of academic freedom, just like civilian colleges and universities across the country. And I have never had anyone question the texts that I've chosen or what we're reading. And I think that that's a wonderful thing. And I think it surprises some people who have a particular idea of the military. But it is an educational institution within that. And I have found that the people in charge have been really vigilant stewards of that academic freedom. And so it makes it a quite wonderful place to teach for that reason.
Talk about what you've learned about the preconceived notions that people have about the U.S. military, and not just the negative ones, but even the positive ones that may or may not reflect reality.
Well, I think in just for me teaching English there, just the very idea that I would, that someone would want anyone to teach English there is sometimes a big hurdle to overcome. And then the immediate assumption would be, well, then you must read only the Iliad.
Mm-hmm.
And so to suggest that we read what students elsewhere might read is also sort of strange for them. The other thing that's interesting to people who don't really know about the faculty at the Military Academy is that a large percentage of the faculty is on a shortened tour, a 3-year assignment. Younger officers, captains and majors, who have served as company commanders and then have gone to graduate school for 2 years to get master's degrees. And it's a vital part of the faculty. And then they teach for 3 years. They have a different kind of connection and relationship to the cadets, having come back to teaching so recently from the field army. And then they go back out into the army, having had that graduate school experience, having been able to be ambassadors in graduate school and explain who they are to their civilian peers, and then having had the opportunity to teach, which brings them into a whole new relationship with cadets, and I think changes the way they go back out into the Army and think about their soldiers and think about their missions.
I was really interested that your students sometimes struggle with the need to preserve the sort of mythology of soldier as hero. And I don't say mythology to imply that it's never true, but the sort of image. And at the same time, they have to grapple with it, because if you say everyone's a hero, then at some point no one's a hero.
And I think culturally we tend to do that, that we have. And again, I think this is probably a Vietnam hangover, that we're atoning for that. We've sort of figured out now we'll divide the soldier. We can condemn the war, but not the soldier. Mm-hmm. We've sort of figured that out. But now I think we have to maybe take it a step farther and actually think about what that might mean, and that soldiers are not they're not all heroes, or they may be heroic in ways we haven't imagined. We still have, I think, a very antiquated notion of what that heroism might look like. And so I think that that's a challenge we will continue to face.
There's also this issue of loyalty, which is – it's easy to say that soldiers need to be loyal, but the question sometimes is, do they need to be loyal to a commander, to a mission, to their fellow soldiers, to a larger truth? Sometimes those things come into conflict.
Right. And, of course, above all, to the Constitution.
Right.
And I think negotiating personal and professional loyalties is always a very difficult business. It's difficult for people who aren't in the military as well, but it just may not be as obvious to them that what they're doing is being loyal to a person or an institution. And that, too, is one of the great things I think that literature helps with, because it often shows confusing networks and contradictory networks of loyalty. And I think that that's part of the growing process, certainly for cadets, figuring out what it might mean to be loyal to principles and what it means to be loyal to people, and what happens when those things come in conflict.
What kinds of letters do you get from your students when they have deployed to active duty in a combat zone? I mean, do you learn about them and who they really are in ways that you, even in the most intensive classroom relationship, couldn't have known?
I think so. And I'm often surprised, not always. Some of my correspondents, I imagined that we would continue a connection. But sometimes I will get emails after years of silence from people I had in a class. And it is really the most remarkable, unexpected, and fulfilling aspect of my job there, in that I feel extremely fortunate to be a part of that sort of network of people really across the world who feel that they can write. And what is the chief characteristic of that correspondence is its honesty. I get the impression that, unlike writing to a family member, they don't necessarily feel they have to censor or protect, or mm-hmm. they can sort of tell it like it is.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad that they feel that way. And I know that they have written from places where they're feeling really mixed emotions about their job and deeply troubled about things, and then also moments where they know they've accomplished something. And so there are letters of great elation and letters of great despair as well. And often part of the conversation then goes back to the books that we read. And so you had mentioned earlier those texts that maybe are sort of like a time release capsule, mm-hmm. that they take a long time, and someone will circle back to that and say, when we read this book, I never imagined that it would have anything to do with me, but I was just in this situation, and I found knowing that book and knowing that character to be able to help me, not necessarily guide me, but knowing that someone had imagined this circumstance before.
And you've at times gone off to the post office and dispatched a package of books.
Yes, that habit, that practice started when a former student wrote and said, you know, I just ran out of books, and I said, well, I can't do much, but I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that became another thing that I really like to do is to be able to send books, either copies of what we're reading in class at the time, or just books that come to hand, or something I think they might like, things about war, things not about war. It doesn't really matter, as long as it's rich and interesting and provocative.
I'm curious about whether the dispatches you've received from your students after they have left your class and they are actively serving have changed your outlook on which literature gets war right.
I think it has. Sometimes they'll surprise me about which texts have illuminated something for them. The other thing that it's changed is how I design courses.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of lieutenants and captains out there who may not know how important their contributions to the curriculum really have become, mm-hmm. because that allows me to see what happens 5 years down the road when they've come to a new relationship with their undergraduate education. So that I will often ask them, I'm debating between these two books for the freshmen or for the seniors. What should we read? And they're often really helpful, and they're really invested in it, because they have a sense of how important it was to them and of how that experience in the classroom was of great value and was a kind of sanctuary, even if they didn't realize it then.
You write about some of your students feeling that there's a sort of pedigree attached to works written by people who have combat experience as opposed to those who don't.
Yeah, it seems that war is that one sphere of human endeavor where suddenly participation becomes the most important mm-hmm. Criterion for writing about it. And so that question will often emerge. Well, so-and-so didn't see combat, so how can she write about it, or how can he write about it? And that often yields really interesting discussions about the imagination. And I'll say, well, if you want to close off war, maybe we should close off other extreme situations from the imagination. Mm-hmm. And by the time we finish whittling it away, there's no more fiction, there's no more poetry. So
right.
Pretty soon they figure out that authenticity must have more to do than just participation.
What do you assign your students that deals with homecoming?
The Odyssey, I think, more than anything, has become a real touchstone for me, and I like to read it with the seniors. And it's a poem that has changed for me over the years, because thinking about Odysseus and many aspects of his story and how just how very different a world that is from the Iliad, it's just as difficult, but difficult in new ways. And I think that that's a really important thing to read with them.
Mm-hmm. How do they interact with one another? And is there are there sort of no holds barred in terms of intensive conversations and disagreements and arguments? I don't know exactly how you structure your classes, but
I think when they feel comfortable with one another, they will argue. I think the more the upperclassmen are more likely to go at it mm-hmm. Ferociously. The plebes, I think, have a real sense of solidarity. It's the plebes against the rest of the world, and so they may be less likely to argue. But they figure out a way to do that in a civil fashion, and that you can argue with people over ideas without it becoming personal. And I think that's as much just an element of growing up for any college student as it is with mine. But maybe because they do feel that automatic solidarity, it may take a little longer for them. But the upperclassmen are always going back and forth about texts and disagreeing with one another, and it's really quite spirited.
So. You open this book with an account of like a parent's weekend, which you write you've always thought were kind of silly and infantilizing. It does have to be different, though, when you know that these parents have really sort of given the country a gift that they may not get back.
Right. And that first scene you talk about is when I was sort of stationed at the front door of the mm-hmm. department greeting these parents. And it did seem like an awful lot of work for this peculiar visitation ritual. But in the years since, I have figured out its importance. And I've also had the opportunity during that same event to speak to the parents about I ran for several years our freshman literature core course. So they all 1,100 of them took this course. So then I got to talk to their parents. Mm-hmm. In our big auditorium. And it was there where I, even though I realized it before, it was there where I really think I understood mm-hmm. How important this was, that they received some insight about what their children were doing and about the institution's relationship to them.
Elizabeth D. Samet is my guest. She's professor of literature at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and author of Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature Through Peace and War at West Point. She's in town to receive the 2012 Hyatt Prize in Humanities from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture tomorrow night. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Elizabeth D. Samet, professor of literature at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and author of Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature Through Peace and War at West Point. She's in town to receive the 2012 Hyatt Prize in Humanities from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We were speaking in the break about 1,100 students in a year who are taking this freshman course and what a responsibility that is to sort of make it count for all of these students who someday will be leaders in the Army.
And I realized in talking to their parents, and I told their parents this, that it was the single most important responsibility I'd been given in my professional life, was to have just a little time with that many future lieutenants, mm-hmm. and how were we going to make it count, and what we were going to do. So they all take the class, 25 or so faculty teaching it. We teach all in small sections, so about 15 to 18 per class, which is lovely. You can really get to know your students. And we do all sorts of things with them. I ran them through acting workshops with the mm-hmm. Hudson Valley Shakespeare Company, and we have them memorize and recite Shakespeare soliloquies. We read Ovid's Metamorphosis. We've been doing that for the last several years, a poem about transformation, obviously, and one I thought that students who were being transformed themselves would find something in, and they have. And part of what I have them do is then rewrite a myth for the present day. And so it often involves certain aspects of West Point and of transformation. And it just gets them as college freshmen, but also as future military officers, to figure out what it means to be transformed, what it means to grow up, what you have to lose and leave behind, and then what you acquire in the process and how you're changed.
Is there a point at which you can sense that they feel transformed as opposed to sort of doing the things that are required to fit in and be part of this culture that exists at West Point?
I think it happens at different stages for different cadets. Mm-hmm. I think it certainly has happened by the time they're seniors, and I've had conversations with the seniors about that moment where they realized this had somehow become a part of them, that they hadn't lost whoever they were when they arrived, and I think that's vital to retain that core. But that they had figured out a way to bridge both identities and to wear them both. And I think the plebes are very much at the other end of the spectrum. Some days they wear it more naturally than others, and they know that. And they have a wonderful perspective about it. And I tell them that's the thing they really shouldn't lose. But they do have a wonderful sense, because they're not quite part of the institution yet, about what it means to become a part of it. And what it means really to speak a new language, to even the wearing of a uniform changes how you walk and how you talk and everything else. And they're still very, very sensitive to all of those things. And so that's a very powerful time to be in the classroom with them.
How does competition with one another play into this? Because I would imagine to get into West Point, you have to be at the very top of your class, you know, in a good high school and all that. But then suddenly you're surrounded by 1,100 other students your age who are every bit as good, if not better.
Right. And so that challenge they share with students at other colleges and universities. But they also have a powerful cooperative ethos and a powerful ethos of teamwork. And that's part of what they learn there. Mm-hmm. And so there is competition. That's inevitable. But there's also, I think, a wonderful, as I said before, the word I used was solidarity. And I think that describes it quite well. And it's not a solidarity I ever felt with automatically anyway with people with whom I went to college.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Greg in Fort Worth. Hi, Greg.
How are you doing, ma'am?
Great, thank you.
I'm a lieutenant in the National Guard, and I got to see one of the professor's products when I was at Benning, and I compliment you on turning out a very fine product, ma'am.
Well, thank you.
I got to spend a year in Iraq last year turning out the lights and leaving them with the political system of South Louisiana, and I got to spend the year reading T.E. Lawrence's Seven Pillars of Wisdom.
That's a book I actually read with my British literature elective many years ago, actually before the war started, and I think that text is a very popular touchstone for many lieutenants and captains who have found themselves in that part of the world.
Is there time to work on things that are lighter somehow, or do you feel like you really have to get to the very meaty things? And I don't mean lighter as an inconsequential, but I mean works that might address different intellectual needs than those that are very, very serious.
I think that's vital, and I think that – and I have often wrestled – I've sort of figured out how to do that, in that there is that sense of urgency and you want to get to these, as you say, meaty, weighty ideas, but that the whole spectrum of literature and of ideas really has to remain in play, especially now. Mm-hmm. And so we do a lot of different genres and different ideas, and actually have a lot of powerful conversations about comedy as a genre and what role it serves, and comparing it to tragedy and figuring that out. I think it's important for them to think about, as they think about the arc of their own lives, you know, what will their lives look like? And how can the sort of the arcs of literary genre help them understand that?
You mentioned earlier that you have them do some recitations, and this turns out to be sort of a bellwether for the kind of individual they might be in terms of their comfort with speaking in front of people. Can you talk about that and how they take this assignment?
Well, the reciting Shakespeare has been a long time part of this class for the freshmen, and it's something that I continued when I took it over, and I made a bigger deal of it. And we do a kind of, I call it Academy Idol. We do a competition throughout the semester, and by the end, the finalists actually perform their scenes or their speeches in front of a big audience in the auditorium. And they get very excited about it. Some of them are very uncomfortable at first and will never get over that discomfort entirely, but they all know they've accomplished something. So we write about the speech, we talk about it, we perform it, and in all of those things, they really own the language in a way they maybe haven't owned language before. And they figure out how a given character's mind might work. And then some of them surprise themselves. They've never done anything, they've never done any drama before, and they suddenly realize they can do it, and they just sort of grow before you. It's really quite remarkable to see that.
You know, in terms of the feeling that they've accomplished something, I don't want to make too much of this, but people talk about the fear of public speaking being every bit as great as the fear, I don't know, of going into a combat zone, but of a lot of other things that people are frightened by. Do you feel like it's important to give them that sense that they can do what for some of them might feel like the hardest thing they have to do?
Absolutely, because they're going to have to do that. They may not realize this, but they're going to have to talk in front of their soldiers, in front of their superiors, in all sorts of contexts. And I think that getting them comfortable with that, with thinking on their feet, with the upperclassmen, we also do a performance, a Shakespeare performance. And as you know, things always go wrong on stage. And you have to figure things out. You have to improvise. And so thinking on your feet, being able to solve problems on the fly like that, I think are vital skills. And so we do that in the Shakespeare elective as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Lloyd on the line now in Tyler. Hi, Lloyd.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I was going to ask, try to kind of get the speaker's opinion concerning the differences you see in politics today and how politics are so partisan and you have less warriors that are in politics, whereas a great example is what the first George Bush did with Colin Powell and Schwarzkopf and the gang and how they understood just to put Saddam Hussein back in the box and you don't go into Iraq. And that wisdom that came with their World War II and Vietnam experiences and how when you get past that, people who are in office don't understand, you know, what needs to be done in those situations.
Yeah, I think I've got your question. Do soldiers make better politicians? And are you thinking of that at all as you're teaching these young people?
I'm not sure whether they automatically make better politicians. I think maybe the more important question is the open dialogue between soldiers and civilians. And I think in the, you know, the caller mentions there are fewer politicians with military service. There are fewer Americans with military service. And I think in the absence of a draft, which we all know we're not reviving anytime soon, we have to find new ways to talk across that divide and to talk in meaningful, important ways so that the more thoroughly we understand the soldiers' experience, perhaps the more thoughtful we are with sending them into harm's way. Similarly, the more familiar and connected and invested soldiers feel in the American civilian life, the easier it is to come home, the easier it is to cooperate in the future. So I think that's always an important issue in a democracy with an all-volunteer force.
So you and I are about the same age, and I don't have a direct connection at this point to anyone of the age of your students who is serving in the military. But I will say my perspective on sending young people into harm's way has evolved from the time I was much younger to the time that now I'm approaching the age where I could be the parent of a student like this or of a soldier. I wonder if you have felt the same evolution yourself. When you started, you were not too much older than the oldest students you had. And now in a few years, theoretically, you could have a child that age.
I don't know that I think of the relationship as parental, but I think the way that I understand that now is because I have more contact with cadet parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can see it. Sympathetic imagination allows me to see it through their eyes. So I often think about them and then think about their parents as well and what that means to send your child. And also I feel a great, you know, personal connection to them. I think I like to hope after they graduate it's the connection of a friend. So I do think that both of those things have played a role in my evolving sense of what this means.
I know that despite the counsel you provide students, you're not giving them psychotherapy or anything. But I wonder if there are things that you deliberately put into your courses that you think, okay, this is a reservoir that someone can draw on. And this is, you know, this is a text for the darkest moment that somebody might face.
I think I often consider Shakespeare in that light, mm-hmm. in that there are so many circumstances and so many situations that are imagined in those plays that there doesn't seem to be a crisis or a difficult passage that in some way he has anticipated or at least in an oblique way can address. And so I think that's probably the role that Shakespeare serves, among other things, among, you know, the beautiful language and all sorts of other powerful aspects of it. But I do think that perhaps more than any other author has kind of served that role.
Shakespeare also doesn't hesitate to show people in various lights. You know, you might have the hero shown to have human flaws.
Right, that there are no wholly admirable characters, and actually, as terrible as many of the villains are, there's something in them that nevertheless appeals. And so investigating that, figuring that out, figuring out that motive is a very difficult thing to ascertain, figuring out also, as Hamlet does, that that the masks people wear are not always accurate in terms of what's within, and so having to negotiate that as well.
Do your students come to you every bit as academically prepared as they did in 1997?
I think that the aptitude is the same. I think that like college freshmen across the world, their attention spans have diminished.
Mm-hmm.
The faculty of deep attention, which multitasking and different media have sort of, I think, lessened. And so getting them to focus on one thing, they're eminently capable of it, but
yeah.
they're not as practiced.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where something like a sonnet is extremely useful, in that you can just look at that discrete little poem for an hour, and they can look up at the end of the hour and think, wow, we spent that long on this short a poem. And to tell them that that's really an accomplishment and that that's a kind of skill, faculty that they need to keep sharp.
Are they as dependent on technology as their peers at other universities?
I think so, although we have certain strict rules about cell phones in class and things like that, which I imagine there are elsewhere. But they are, and that's why sometimes I just like them to put their laptops away and actually have a conversation. And that's kind of I think that's a novelty for college students sometimes. I love technology as much as mm-hmm. the next person, but it's also fun to play the Luddite a bit. And just to have the book there in front of you is a wonderful thing. And fortunately, it's something that the discipline of literature allows you to do.
Elizabeth D. Samet is professor of literature at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and author of the book Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature Through Peace and War at West Point. The book is now available in paperback. Elizabeth is in town to receive the 2012 Hyatt Prize in Humanities from the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture, and that all happens tomorrow night. Elizabeth, it's been such a pleasure to have you in. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think, which is also where you can download those podcasts. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions for the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.